On the agenda today is, first we're going to have the presentation to the committee of the special efforts in alcoholism, and then Wally Miller will give us an analysis of the capital budget, I guess, that some of the things that he's discovered for us to consider in the appropriation process. Okay, what I'd like to do is give a, I'll try to keep it short, give you a short overview of how I got to this place here, and then we've got a couple of people that can answer more specific questions. You should have before you, about a 17-page leaflet on special efforts in response to alcoholism and alcohol abuse problems. The appropriations for alcohol and alcohol abuse problems have stayed relatively level for the last 4 years. That is, we have not increased them, either expanding the programs or even keeping up with inflation. It's been around 2.6 million for the last 4 years. And I've had that budget three of those 4 years, and I also have not increased it. One of the concerns has been that we haven't really been sure whether or not they've really been of any significant help. And I promised myself when I went through last year that I'd take some time in the interim to really look into it. And I had a chance to do that, and I've been pretty well, you know, converted that the problem is really not so much that the programs are ineffective, but that the legislature has not really made an effort to provide the resources. One of the analogies I have kind of come to is that it's like taking a bucket of water and throwing it on a burning building, and then since it didn't put the fire out, making the conclusion that water is not effective against fire. I think we need to increase the efforts in the areas that we are working now, but we need to expand them. For instance, one of the main things we're working on right now, our budget is primarily comprised of money for treatment, and even that is an inadequate amount. We have no money, or very little money, for prevention, education, evaluation, research, any of those things. So what this is a comprehensive effort which takes the one thing that we're doing now, that is treatment, and tries to improve upon that, but adds to it several other areas of effort. And if you'll take the page 16 of this booklet, you can see an overview of the appropriations that are being advocated. The total comes to $15,270,000.
I move the number.
And just to run through that, under treatment, we'd have emergency care, inpatient care, intermediate care, long-term care, outpatient care, outreach, and aftercare. And then there we'd have a new component, which would be intervention. And we've isolated different target populations that would be the most efficient to work on. That is, some occupations, drunk drivers, misdemeanor offenders, public inebriates, and corrections. I might say that in corrections, we have information that indicates that 85% of all incarcerated, all people incarcerated in state jails there's a high correlation between their offense and drinking. They were at the very least drunk while apprehended, and some of them the crimes are directly related to alcohol abuse. Then under prevention, we have education. One of the programs would be K-12, which is something we just started last year, which has been tremendously effective. And then special projects is trying to provide a sum of money so that any community that has a particular community-based response, that has a response that's appropriate for that particular community, would be able to apply for money under these funds. And one of the best examples of that is a community in Philip Guy's district. I think it's in Poskiak.
No, Poskiak.
Yes, and they've been receiving a small grant of, I think, $20,000. And they run a riverboat up and down the river to try to reduce the traffic and apprehend the people going up and down the river. So this would be for innovative projects or for projects that are peculiar to a certain area that the village council or the community council or whatever felt would be effective, and they would apply for money under this area. Then, of course, there's public education through the mass media, some some public education would be implemented, and we have very little of that now from the state level, there's some on the federal level. Of course, administering these grants would require some increase in administrative component, and then we need training for the increase in training. Evaluation, $750,000 would be a major part of the component. One of the complaints that you get from some of the legislators is that we really don't know whether these programs are being effective or not, and we really have no way of making that determination. In fact, one legislator asked the Division of House Research to analyze the programs and determine whether they're effective, and they came back and said, there's no way to make that determination. So this would provide a very strong evaluation component. This idea is to have this for 5 years, a 5-year program. The appropriation we're looking at is just for this first year, that 5 years. It'd be a 5-year effort. During that, we'd have a lot of, tremendous amount of evaluation, and those programs that were doing well would hopefully be continued funding. Those that weren't doing well, we'd drop out of the program, so that we'd have a way of screening out those that are not effective. And I think that the agency people have been told that, you know, there's that reaper to pay, that they have to be able to show that their program is somehow being effective, and we're not going to continue to be funded. And then, of course, some research. Total would be $15,220,000, as I said. And there's a breakout by region. One of the aspects of this is that, I think it's 4.9, what's the second number? Okay, 4.9 million of this figure would go in the supplemental. And it was so that we could get started right away. It would not lapse at the end of this fiscal year, but lapse at the end of next fiscal year. So I put those together rather than try to make it look like there's really only 10 million. The FY81 budget will only include 10 million, but the total figure that we'll appropriate this year will be 15.2 million, and next year the request will be, you know, commensurate with 15.2 as opposed to 10 million. It's a large increase in terms of a percentage increase, but I think if you look at our total budget where we're spending, you know, $1.2 billion, and the number one health problem in the state is alcohol abuse. And some people think it's the number one social problem as well. It's not a very high percentage of your budget to be spending on the worst problem that you have. Now, we run number one in the state, I mean in the nation, in child abuse. We have the worst rate of child abuse. We have the worst rate of violence in some of our communities. We have the worst rate of accidental death by drowning and fire. And just about everything that we have the worst rate in the nation on is extremely highly correlated with alcohol abuse. And I think that if we would attack that problem, we could make some real gains in some of the other areas, like child abuse, for instance. And in fact, that's how I came about to be concerned about alcohol abuse, was, as you all know, I've been working trying to improve funding for child abuse, and as I looked into it, upwards of 90% of the child abuse cases are very highly correlated with alcohol abuse, and that's why I became interested in trying to get at the source of the problem rather than just trying to apply band-aids, you know, everywhere there was an outbreak. There's also information provided in, I don't know if it's before you, but we have it in the committee on what the total costs, if I remember correctly, statewide, the costs to the state, not to the state government, but to the people of the state, is $138 million a year. So we're talking about spending $15.2 million, and it will probably save the people of the state, you know, 3 or 4 times that much every year if it has any effect whatsoever. So every dollar spent is going to bring back to the people of the state, I think, quite a bit of money. Just there is also a figure for direct state costs, that is, you know, the police arresting drunk drivers and that type of thing. Do you remember that number, Dennis?
About 26 million.
26 million. So it costs us, we spend $26 million of the current budget, not directly on the problem of alcohol, but indirectly, to pay for the police pick up the public inebriate or stop the fight or whatever it is, or to go to the domestic quarrel or try to place the victim of child abuse or something like that. So hopefully, and it's you know, it's not predictable what effect we'll have, but I think that the amount of money we're spending is a reasonable thing to do on its own merits, but just in terms of cost-benefit analysis, it probably will provide some savings to stay in another area. Okay, with that overview, I've got several people here that are very knowledgeable. Dennis Kelso, Director of Alcan Associates, he was hired by myself on contract to help put this plan together, and the Director of the State Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse is also here. And I wanted to bring this before you because I'm going to be putting in the request for $4.9 million for the supplemental budget. And we can look at the other things, I guess, separately, but it's really one package. And so I wanted to bring it before you for questions and have the people here to ask questions. I know most people are familiar with the effort I've talked about on the floor and stuff, but I just wanted to bring it forward. So if there's any questions, now would be the time to ask. I don't know if anyone's had a chance to look at this one.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Guy?
Yeah, under the prevention subtitle, special projects, at the present time, our regional health corporation, the Yukon Health Corporation, recently developed a plan which is similar to Nakaskak, Akachak, but it covers the entire region. My thinking is this, that there should be a mechanism whereby the regional health corporation can apply for those villages, so it would not be piecemeal, but it would be more comprehensive.
Mr. Cole, Mr. Castle, would you come forward, please? Did you hear the question?
First part.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Bob Cole from the State Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse.
Dennis Kelso from Alcan Associates.
Mr. Guy, you're right about the Yukon-Kuskokwim application or the plan for that particular health corporation region for area-wide application of funds to individual corporations. I think what's interesting about the way that this particular document is put together is that every single health corporation region in the rural areas of Alaska, in their tribal specific health plan that they do for under the auspices of the Health Care Improvement Act for the federal government, has got alcohol abuse and alcoholism as one of the top three health priorities in their plan. And those are also reflected in all three of the health systems agency plans that are prepared for the three health systems areas of the state of Alaska through the Health Planning Act that was funded by the legislature about 3 years ago. And there's an existing grant aid statute that is also on the books, Alaska Statute 4730-475, that provides a mechanism for implementing a whole statewide alcoholism program. And so the manner in which that the goals and objectives of that plan for Yukon-Kuskokwim would get implemented would be through that grant name process in the manner in which the present proposal was put together. And that's a system they're very familiar with because, as you know, they've been coming to us for the last 2 or 3 years trying to get funds, and we've not been able to respond to it for a variety of reasons, mostly which is money.
Under this, you would have that.
Right.
Do you have any comments to make that I might have skipped over or emphasized not enough that you noticed?
I've got one.
Yeah.
I know that I've appeared before you ladies and gentlemen before, and at different points down the last 4 or 5 years, you've sort of heard what I've had to say, and I realize, in fact, it's become a matter of some consternation on my part that whenever a state agency employee appears, there's a lot of question in people's mind about whether or not that person's telling you accurate facts, whether or not they're just trying to feather their own nest and that kind of thing. I think what's interesting about this particular effort is that Mr. Meekins held a number of public hearings this summer. And at those public hearings, he had meetings with all the people from the regional health corporations in Western Alaska and the various municipal governments that operate alcoholism and drug abuse programs and the private nonprofit corporations. And if I'm not mistaken, Ms. Whalen has a big three-ring binder with all those local community concept papers that were presented to you. So really what's being presented is not something from a state agency. What's being presented is an aggregate of requests from local communities scattered throughout the state. And I think that it's a value judgment whether or not you want to do this kind of thing, I think that there isn't any question in anybody's mind. If you talk to the people in public safety, Commissioner Nix or any of his troopers or Colonel Anderson, or if you talk to the people in the courts, the prosecutors or the people doing public health nursing in rural Alaska or any of the other people that are involved in dealing with health and criminal justice and social services problems throughout the state, that they'll all tell you that it, just in terms of magnitude dollar cost, you know, there's a terrific amount of money being spent on responding to alcoholism and drug abuse problems through the criminal justice system primarily, but also through those other kinds of programs. It's a little bit, I don't know how much, well, you can cut me off, Mr. Chairman, whatever you want to do, but it's a little bit of a problem in my own mind about the comment that I've heard in years past about the alcoholism programs not being effective. I would suggest to you that that they are, and I think that House Research is going to have a report for you in a couple of weeks that doesn't give you a final clear-cut answer on that particular issue, but points out some of the problems with knowing that in a scientific way, and also some of the things they can tell you that are accurate about the current performance of those programs. But in comparison to the other things that are going on with regard to alcoholism and alcohol abuse, criminal justice, social services, corrections, probation, parole, prosecution, if there's money down a rat hole, I'm not suggesting that those agencies or organizations don't spend their money properly, but it's the practice of spending tens and tens of millions of dollars in ever-increasing increments every year that goes by for a problem that is not being attacked directly through the application of prevention and treatment services. And I, you know, I guess my argument, biased as I am, would be for an effort to attack the problem itself and not its consequences. And I do think there are ways that you can measure the effectiveness of that.
Just to echo the other side of this, and that saying that what we're talking about now in terms of the package we put together is a comprehensive approach, and I think that Representative Meekins mentioned that at the beginning, but just to say in a different way that in the past there's been money pretty much for treatment only, and that everybody has known as a community that that's really not the answer, that the profession, or that the prevention and the intervention programs, the training, evaluation, research, are all the very important, or also very important aspects of the program, and that what we're trying to do now is not anything particularly new or additional, but really bring the level of combating the problems of alcoholism and alcohol abuse up to a level of being able to effectively and comprehensively deal with all aspects of the problem, and that's really important. On the other side of it, the structure or the mechanism that's being put forth is not one where definite programs or definite solutions are being prescribed for all areas of the state. Rather, through the mechanisms and the grant and aid mechanisms that Mr. Cole described, is that there'll be flexibility for all communities, all parts of the state, to prepare applications and to apply for money by components of comprehensive services in ways and manners that are unique and specific to their particular regions. Certainly the problems that present themselves in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau are quite different than the problems and the way they're presented and the way you deal with them in Barrow or Nome, Togue, or Kodiak. And so that flexibility is built in. There's nothing standard, there's nothing forced, but rather there is a component by component designation of not only funding, but of types of programs that could be utilized, so that there is that flexibility. And this is also based on the tenants or the provisions of the Uniform Act for the state, which also indicates that the services should be available and accessible to all parts of the state. And up to this point, there just hasn't been money and funding to be able to provide that kind of service statewide, systematically, and regionally to all areas of the state. But I think that those aspects of it are built into the program as a mechanical feature.
I have a question, I don't know, for Mr. Torres, Mr. Council. On page 16 of the report here, perhaps, I've often thought that one of the ways that you, one of the alcoholism program should be in the prevention area instead of waiting to get either treatment or interventions. You should start educating or doing whatever you need to at a young age so that people never reach the point where they're alcoholics and have further problems in centers and so on. How did you arrive at a breakdown as to how much money you were going to funnel into, for example, prevention? How much you're recommending? Also, I'm reading these figures and I see $3,170,000 prevention total, but I don't see how that breaks down between various programs, I guess. I don't see that, where that totals to $3 million. Well, those four total to $3,170,000?
Yeah.
Okay, and then how does that break down between regions? How did you determine the breakdown between regions?
Well, the regional question I'm going to defer.
Because the regional distribution is theoretical at this point. It's based on an estimation of how the resources might be distributed given the population distribution and what is known intuitively about the problems throughout the state in the different areas. Now, to the best that we could, the certain amounts of the program of the prevention money are distributed over the health service region, but the remainder of it, most of it is going to be, or is slated anyway, for distribution on a statewide basis. The K-12 education curriculum, for example, is being implemented right now in a number of schools throughout the state, and that's being done through a contract and through one central agency, but it goes throughout various regions, and all the regions of the state are represented. Now, it's very difficult. The money isn't actually going into the regions as for these programs, but it's being spent in those regions on training teachers and presenting curriculum, so we couldn't prorate it over the regions. And so it's just set up under the totals column.
Perhaps I don't understand this schedule back here. Take the prevention line, where prevention in caps, plus $3,170,000, then directly across the sky, southeast $150,000, south central $900,000, northern $450,000. What's that mean?
That's to the extent that the information is available, that's how much of the prevention money through the programs that you see and also down below are distributed. These community responses at the bottom. Okay, you see where it says community responses designated for rural programs? That totals $1,500,000. That is distributed in the other way of $150,000, $900,000, $450,000for each of the three regions. The figure up at the top is the recap, the summary. Now, there is no other distribution for K-12 special projects or public education, so the same figures are repeated there.
Okay, so for education, K-12, for special projects and public education, there's no distribution on that yet.
Yeah,
that will be decided by the department.
It's centrally distributed.
Well, there is one other. I think there is one other item in there too, Mr. Duncan. It's like the public education mass media program. If you remember the old stuff that used to be on television that the National Council on Alcoholism Alaska Region put on, that cost about $350,000-$400,000 a year, and that project terminated about two years ago. So just a rough estimate of what it would cost to duplicate an effort of that magnitude using electronic media was $500,000.
You know,
the thrust of it would be totally different and would be
briefly explain community responses. What does that mean?
Okay, the components that you see identified in the budget columns are the standard components that are used for on a national level as standards of alcohol treatment, and also the standards of care. The standards for certifying or approving programs are based on this comprehensiveness. Now, the community responses was another category that was inserted because in all the areas of the state, having the standard kinds of treatment programs that work in urban areas doesn't make a great deal of sense. There's better ideas, there are alternative ideas. Local communities have unique or innovative ideas of how to deal with community problems. An example is Barrow right now that's been undergoing a prevention or a community prevention point, a program that has nothing to do with inpatient treatment or outpatient treatment. It's a response by the community. So it's an open category of funding, but designated money, so that smaller communities, particularly rural, can devise the kinds of programs that seem to be most appropriate for their areas and have a segment or a pool of money to draw from to make application, so that that money isn't used up by other programs in other parts of the state for conventional treatment programs from where they work. So it's kind of an attempt to safeguard a certain amount of money for unique and innovative approaches in small and widely scattered population areas of the state.
Okay, one further follow-up. Now, are you convinced that you're weighted correctly here between treatment, intervention, prevention?
Partial answer to that question. Last year, we had a total of almost $8 million worth of applications, mostly for treatment programs. And we know that there are a number of communities throughout the state that have got I think one fellow from Northern Region put it best, you know, sort of like he had the lid on the garbage can, then they were going to figure out how to go about reducing problems. But most of the communities throughout the state, especially in rural Alaska, with the exception of Bethel, don't even have something as fundamental as a detox system that they can use, or an inpatient or outpatient or intermediate care program that they can use, and they've got lots of people who are in trouble right now. So that the money for treatment is...
What you're saying is it's pretty clear that you need this much money for treatment, which is not to say that there isn't more needed for prevention. I mean, I think it's kind of like, you know, you got this crisis out there, people are dropping dead left and right. You need to do something to address that emergency. But the long-term solution is really in the prevention. And if we were going to do it full scale, we'd probably end up having more in prevention than we would in treatment. But this is just the first step.
I'm going to interject something here. The treatment categories, like every single one of the rural health corporations in years past has submitted an application to us for basic treatment services for their particular community or region. And that includes Bethel, Dillingham, Kotzebue, Nome, Barrow, Southeast Communities, Huna, and Angoon, and a number of others. Most of those we have funded, you know, at maybe a fifth or a tenth or a quarter of what they requested. But just in terms of treatment services, they've had requests into us three successive times now at a minimum, you know, and every time they get more and more frustrated and angry because we can't do anything with that. So that the one thing that I think that you were asking about that isn't immediately clear when you look at the breakdown of this thing at first blush, you know, is that a large portion of that treatment money would be available to rural Alaska for standing plans that they've had for the last three years that they would like to implement in communities. In addition to that, a couple of areas that people have been working with, like YK area, has a whole preventative approach for their villages that they want to use. Norton Sound Health Corporation region has a whole different approach that they want to use for the Norton Sound region. And that community responses piece of that money there was designed to provide money for demonstration projects that regions want to try on an experimental basis to see whether or not they'll work in their communities.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't even get started on this, but to me, I agree with Mr. Duncan. To me, it seems kind of ludicrous. So I look up here and I see $670,000 in education K-12 of a total of $15,270,000.
Can I give you an example of something, Mr. Green?
Let me finish. I suspect, and all that, you talk about some of the programs, and I'm not going to knock the intervention and the treatment programs, but I suspect that if I really knew how much of the money that and located in treatment and intervention was going to pay somebody's wages, and when I think how much good you could actually do if you were spending even a fraction of that, and I don't even consider $670,000 a fraction of that in education K-12, educating people, you know, what it is to become a drunk and what the ill effects are. I'm not too impressed, and I don't think I have any reason to be, even if you put $100 million into how many drunks you're going to cure. So, you know, maybe the chairman's right that it should be more and more money, but I'm not convinced, and it bothers me to see only $670,000 out of the $15,270, where I think it really is going to do some good.
Let me respond to that, because I think I agree with your, you know, with your basic attitude very strongly. The point to remember is that up until last year, the amount under prevention for education, special projects, public education, and community responses was zero. And last year, the legislature appropriated $600,000, first time for the K-12 program, which has had, I think, pretty good success, at least from what we can measure it now. But the fact is that we've been, I think the state has been remiss over the years by emphasizing treatment and not the education, not the prevention aspect. I agree with you on that. This is a big step forward to go. We're now going to be spending more in prevention than we spent over the last 4 years on a yearly basis totally. And we're spending over $3 million on prevention. And last year, total budget was $2.6 million for treatment.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm not going to debate this right now. In the end, I'm just going to agree with you and go along with whatever you want anyway, so it doesn't make a difference. But I have a feeling when you start talking about the state, that's their first problem. In the first place, the parents and the teachers should have been doing this all along, as far as I'm concerned, without having to be paid for by state money. But if, you know, if that's what it takes additional educators, you know, I'm in favor of that. I'm willing to pay that. But I think that if we think we're going to solve this problem by treating it after it's happened, I think we're going to be in for a lot of disappointment. I'm not saying it isn't worth the gamble, worth the try, and on that base I'll go along with it. But I think the emphasis should be on...
Mr. Chairman, well, we're going to be taking that, you know, I hope that we'll take that gamble because of the response has been before. Yeah, we recognize that literally people are dying because of this problem. And yet, because of a frustration on our part, feeling that there really wasn't much we could do about it, we haven't made an attempt to do anything about it. Now, what I'm proposing is that we make this attempt, given the skepticism that people have that we can do anything, and that we fund a very, very strong evaluation component. You can see $750,000 for evaluation. And we take this as on an experimental basis, and that it's worth the money because of the seriousness of the problem. And given the state revenues, it's worth the effort on an experimental basis. And we'll have that a very strong evaluation component, and maybe it'll come in and maybe it'll say this money's going down a rat hole. But I don't believe that. I think that it's going to come back and it's going to say some of these are being effective and some are not being effective, and we'll wipe those out that aren't working and try to improve on those that are doing some kind of good. But it's a five-year effort, and that's the... You know, you definitely have a point, and I think it's reflective of exactly what you're thinking, is why for the last 4 years when I've had this budget, I haven't increased even with inflation because of that same sensation. But I think it's time that we make a push for it, and then later on there might be lots of people around with, I told you so, but I won't, and that's not the case.
I just had one question for information. We put in $600,000 last year, didn't we, in the K-12?
Yes.
How was that distributed? Was that through DOE?
It was put out on a competitive bid request for proposal. I had about 16 applicants for the thing that formed a separate contract evaluation committee under the Administrative Act and bid it. And left to one contractor with a subcontract of the Southeast Region.
Well, you let the contract, but what did you do? I mean, did you put some of that stuff up in my schools up in Delta and Enana and Polk?
Sure did.
What did you actually do?
If you'd like to talk with the people who are doing the projects, they're here in town right now. I could get them over here later on.
That won't be necessary. I think the thing to point out is that the money was not really to provide it, but simply to train teachers so that they can provide.
Okay, this is what I want to know.
That's the difference.
I mean, you actually were training instructors and teachers.
Right.
And providing there's a whole, what they call a bucket of material. There's curriculum, printed curriculum material, film strips and films that they also provided the schools and taught.
That was the way
that answered my question.
Right. For $600,000, you couldn't do much on a state.
No, I realize that, but I was just curious to know what results they had. And I mean, I didn't hear the kids talking about it much, so.
Let's
go. There's only one, comment that I wanted to make, Mr. Freeman, I might not be able to make you feel any better about this at this point in time, but I just wanted to point one thing out. About 5 years ago, the usual age of a person going through an alcoholism treatment program in the state of Alaska was between 45 and 50 years old. And about 2 years ago, the legislature passed that 3-day mandatory on-by statute and provided some monies through the Highway Safety Office for report screening programs for on-by offenders. And as a consequence of that, and the fact that programs have been really trying to work hard with the juvenile courts and with the other outreach efforts that were not geared at the old-time public offender sort of alcoholic, of the 5,600 people that received services last year, over 50% of them were between the ages of 20 and 39, and most of them were employed or employable, one or the other. And I think what we've seen during that five-year period of time is a real drift to the younger population that still isn't chronic alcoholic yet, maybe but beginning to get into trouble with it. And I really think that you get a lot better treatment outcome from dealing with that younger population. the bulk of alcohol abusers in the state of Alaska, just on a proportionate basis, are Caucasian male craftsmen, believe it or not, between the ages of 20 and 39, and they're not sort of the old chronic debilitated alcoholic. So I wanted you to know that a substantial proportion of the limited amount of existing treatment money is going into a younger population, a lot of them who have a court hold on them while they're in the treatment program. You do get a lot better treatment outcome that way than you otherwise would.
Margaret remains the same. It's a lot better to educate them to the evils in the beginning than to treat them after.
I certainly don't disagree.
I would just add a comment there, too, that I think, though, that what we've been recognizing, we've been doing a great deal of research around the state, is that certainly there's other places that people become educated in schools in the ways of drinking and responses to drinking problem other than in public schools. And perhaps it's an unfair burden to put the resolution of the state problems of the drinking habits of the adults of Alaska on the youth of Alaska in school and use that institution as the mechanism for accomplishing the job they have their hands full right now doing the task that they have to do. I think it's an important component to consider. But when the courts do identify somebody with an alcohol drinking problem, the 3,500 male people who are arrested for drunk driving throughout the state each year, what are they supposed to do with them? After they spend their time in jail and 3 days and they're commonly recognized as having an alcohol problem, what then? And this is primarily what the courts have been saying all along. Yeah, we know all our cases are alcohol related, but what do we do with them? And then we can say, well, let's wait, we'll have a cadre of educated people coming through the ranks. Well, obviously, I don't mean to oversimplify what you say, but I'm saying that right now the need is there as more and more of the social systems have responded and have seen the need for dealing with adults who are, by and large, working, functional people who are driving their cars, who are out working, who are maintaining a job, who are using healthcare services, who also have alcohol problems. And those are the people that are in our target groups that we're trying to reach. Now, unless we have adequate and available alcohol treatment programs for that group of people, we won't be doing our job very well. And that's what we mean by a comprehensive system. Yes, the education for the youth, but also we must have a responsive system for the other people who are being identified. And I know you haven't had a chance to look at your little booklet yet, but on the second or third page, there's a little diagram that identifies some of the primary target groups that will be trying to be reached with all the different types of programs. And that's again in response to the initial charge that we must deal with the state problems statewide and comprehensively, not just with systems and segments of the population.
Okay, we still have Wally Miller to listen to today, and I'm trying to get out here a little early. I don't know if we're going to make it or not. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Good body. Is that me?
My name is Jay Hogan, Director of Legislative Finance. I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce Wally Miller, on my left, who has been retained by our office to do a variety of things in the area of capital project analysis. Briefly, what I thought today is I'd like to have him give a quick run-through for the committee on four or five of the projects he's had an opportunity to look at so far, these being governor's projects submitted in the supplemental budget. And so without further ado, I'll have him start, and I'll pass out information on the projects that were reviewed, plus a letter that I wrote late last year to the chairman, kind of outlining the kinds of things that he is going to do for us, the first of which being this analysis of specific projects, and we have several examples of that.
Thank you, Mr. Holden. Mr. Miller, would you care to proceed?
Thank you, Representative Freeman, and members of the committee. While he's passing out that information, I'll just briefly tell you a little bit about my background and qualifications for functioning as a capital budget analyst for the state of Alaska. I was senior financial officer, budget director for Governor Dan Evans for 8 years. Prior to that, I spent 9 years in various financial management positions within the Boeing Company. I have a master's degree in business administration on the University of Washington. 1974, I formed my own firm, Miller & Associates Incorporated. And since that time, we've done about 15 large budget and accounting systems installations, as well as many other management consulting contracts. One of the things I think that's particularly noteworthy, in 1967, when I took on the job of running Washington State Finances, the capital budget process that was in existence at that time in that state was to best be described as in a state of shambles. Project cost overruns were typical, schedules were never kept, the buildings were designed and built, and when they were completed had little regard to what was intended by the legislature. So given those series of problems, we initiated in 1968 a series of changes in our capital construction program designed to bring about more realistic pricing, better schedule control, and better project management. I think we achieved at least a significant portion of those goals. So it is with this background in mind and some work I recently completed for the governor's office on the design of a new state automated budget system that Mr. Hogan asked me to serve as a capital budget analyst for this session of the legislature and to begin by examining a series of capital projects in the supplemental budget. As of this point in time, I've examined and have reports in front of you on 5 of those capital projects. And what I would like to do is briefly describe some of those capital projects and just simply highlight for you some of the issues which I see are yet to be resolved in those proposed projects. The 5 projects are the proposal to upgrade the Subport building. The second project is the project to renovate and replace state employee housing. The completion of the Ketchikan Jail is the third project. Hatchery modification. I'll learn your names better up here over time, I'm sure. And then we combine 4 projects relating to firefighting into 1 project, and it's the last memo that you have in your staff. So what I'd like to do, and feel free to stop and ask any questions, I might want to come on with further information. But the first project we conducted analysis of is the proposal to upgrade the Subport building. And I really think that there are 2 primary issues in that particular capital project. And first of all, does it make any sense to continue to put state dollars on a piecemeal basis in a warehouse that's 40 years old, which has a limited life and a limited utility? And the second point deals with the apparent lack of consideration of alternatives in the capital budget process as submitted to the legislature. In other words, there were no alternatives presented to the legislature other than the piecemeal renovation of the Subport building. Those are the 2 issues that seem to me to be of significance in that capital project. In examining that building and the needs of the tenants, reading architectural reports prepared about the building, it is evident to me that there are, in fact, transportation vacant. But it would at least provide a safe and healthy working environment for the employees who are working in that building. The estimated cost of that alternative is approximately $1 million, and that has been estimated by a local consulting firm. Second alternative would be to completely renovate the Subport building, to bring it up to minimum code, as well as renovate all of the office space in there. This would entail moving the administrative division of ADF&G and their computer operations, which are now currently housed separately, back into the building. The estimated cost of the complete renovation of the building is estimated to be between $4 and $5 million. That would still leave you with a 40-year-old warehouse which has been renovated. A third alternative would be to have limited new facility to house ADFMG, to demolish the present subport building and use that site for a combination of purposes. One would be for expanded state employee parking. One would be for a new armory site should the city acquire the present armory site and provide compensatory facilities to the state. The third would be to use the site for, in conjunction with an armory or without the armory, for a combined small boat maintenance and repair facility between ADFMG and the National Guard. They are in the process of acquiring a number of vessels, the Alaska National Guard is, and they need a repair facility which would be financed by the federal government. It seems to me to be logical to consider both the needs of ADFMG in terms of boat repair and military department together. I met with the leadership of the military department. They have concluded that they could have joint occupancy of a single facility, so it would allow you to have one joint facility rather than two separate facilities. The fourth alternative indicated the new facilities, and that would only house ADFMG headquarters. The estimated cost of that facility is a little over $6 million. The fourth option that we looked at was to have a complete new facility which would house not only the ADFMG statewide staff, but their regional staff as well. The cost of that alternative would be between $11 and $12 million. So at least I think we provide you in our analysis with a range of options. We've made no recommendations as to whether the buildings ought to be leased or purchased. We believe that's a separate determination. But at least I believe we've provided you with a range of alternatives to simply the piecemeal repair of a very old building, which I suspect will cost you on a piecemeal basis substantially greater sums over the years than its demolishment and ultimate replacement.
President Duncan, I'm
not sure I understand these alternatives. What if the alternative was that to lease private space? For example, if a private firm would build a building, lease it to the state, why would there be so much additional cost?
What I've already
incurring lease costs.
Sure. Yeah. What I've expressed that all of the alternatives in terms of a purchase price, so that you could make some cost comparison. Once you select an alternative, then that alternative could be made in terms of either purchase or lease the alternative.
Yeah, for example, alternative four here was just completed facilities. Say, add additional purchase or lease space to house ADFMG regional personnel. Yeah. You got an estimated cost of $11 to $12 million. It's not that costly to lease. There wouldn't be hardly any additional cost.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that I've expressed it all on one basis, so I can make a comparison. In other words, I expressed it all in terms of purchase, but the lease option would certainly be equally as viable.
I guess my point was that perhaps then the phrase add additional purchased or lease space is incorrect, that it should be.
Oh, what I'm indicating is that we make no preference in terms of our analysis, or we have no way to make a distinction between whether it's better in your interest to either lease or purchase. But what I have expressed the price for comparative purposes in terms of purchase dollars.
I guess what I'm wondering is, maybe I'm getting off here, but wouldn't it be a good idea to express to us what it would, the additional cost would be if they were to lease the, how many square feet they have? 30-some thousand?
33,000.
33,000. If they were to lease 33,000, a new building in town, built by a private enterprise,
yeah,
what would be the additional cost? I think it would be very small additional cost, isn't that correct? It wouldn't be $11 to $12 million as I read this.
If you, depends on the term of your lease, and I don't know enough about what your constitutional limits are in terms of lease, but if it's a 10 or 20 year lease, it depends on the term of how they bid the lease and when they do the full cost recovery on the building. If it's over 20 years, they price it out to, receive 100% depreciation at that point, the price would be the same.
I guess maybe I'm not understanding. I guess my point is, if you stay in the old building, if you just remodel and stay in the old building, we still have, are we paying rent or lease on that, Jay?
I don't think so. Okay.
That's a state facility.
I thought that was somehow in a deal with the feds. It's not.
Well, I think those have been
That has been cleared off? Okay, fine, I understand.
Mr. Chairman?
Following along with what Representative Duncan said on alternative four, the 12 million, I understand, but what's the square footage on that one?
That addition would be 28,000 square feet in addition to the...
To the 33?
To the 33, yes.
Mr. Chairman? So one thing I'd like to call attention to in this particular analysis that is different from what we have traditionally seen. Over a period of years, the staff have made suggestions to DOT and the executive that when a major project presents itself, such as a major new facility, that the legislature be given the alternates that the agency went through when they made their decision. In other words, the governor has a perfect right to suggest, to recommend which alternate he likes and is putting forth to the legislature. But the legislature also has a perfect right to know about all the alternates that they consider, not just in one or two or three lines at the tail end of the project description that says we consider some of the above, all the above, none of the above, but some real fleshed out alternates. And so one of the things that Wally did in this project was to treat each one as a separate capital budget project, each alternate. And we would recommend that in the future that the executive be suggested to submit major projects along this same format so that you have something to choose from other than the approved solution.
What we're trying to provide, Mr. Chairman, is a range of options to make sure that the most effective solution is presented, is considered by the executive branch and presented to the legislature. And certainly if you select a particular option, then a sub-optimization of that would be decide whether to purchase or whether to lease. We haven't attempted to work in this short period of time a solution to that level of detail. The second project that we examined was the proposal to renovate and replace some employee housing.
Before you do that, tell me what the situation is on employee housing. I mean, we try to provide housing for employees in the rural areas or something like that. Is it a statute? Or?
We provide housing for a number of state employees that, in terms of public safety for troopers, particularly that are outstationed in villages. We provide housing for people in hatcheries. We provide housing for game agents. Provide, I believe, some institutional housing for people that are involved in the corrections program. So in all, currently, I believe you have some little over almost 380 housing units for trailer pets. And you have housing units in state parks for state rangers. They're there to make sure that keeps vandalism down and they're there to direct people, tourists, through the facility. So in some areas, you simply can't get away from providing on-site housing or protecting your property or making sure that you monitor the people in a correctional facility.
And we have some currently, right? And this is a proposal to renovate those we have or build new?
Currently, the plan is to take the current inventory of housing and trailer pads from about 383 down to about 300, and I'll have to call out the figure in my mind. I think what it gets down to is the 215 housing units is what they'd like to get to. And looking at those 215 housing units, based upon a survey that was conducted this year, 52 of them are in poor condition, 69 are in fair condition, and 94 are in good condition. Those are the ones that they're currently down to, with the housing units exclusive of trailer pads. The plan presented by the executive branch is to replace 18 of the poor units and 2 of the fair units, to renovate 10 of the poor units, to renovate 59 of the fair units, to dispose of 24 of the poor units, and 8 of the fair units, and 5 of the good units. And again, that's because of location variances. That's mixed. But the ultimate plan is to come out with 178 good units plus the 28 that are in the pipeline now for an overall of 206 units.
Well, you said the plan is to reduce it by 83 units, but how do you, must be some reason for that.
What they're going to do is simply dispose of a lot of vacant
That they're not using?
That they're not using. Vacant housing, vacant trailer.
Disposed of how? Selling?
Selling it, yes.
And is that, okay, I just want to know, is the money being received for that being used to offset these costs at all?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, how they take in, I assume that they sell it.
It just goes in the general fund.
Goes in the general fund, yes.
These are units that the state owns?
Yes, that's correct.
What's going to happen in some of these areas where we have a housing problem that they don't own anything yet? They're trying to lease maybe and they haven't taken care of it. I have a situation up at Cantwell, for example, where we had a contractor that was supposed to build a unit with two troopers there. And he's out in limbo. Are they going to purchase more units or what?
What they're trying to do is to get the Department of General Administration, their Division of Purchase and Supply, took over this program a year ago. First thing they did was go out and take an inventory of all the units, housing they had and all the trailer pads, dispose of those ones in the areas where they had no need for employee housing, and then begin to address the need of where they need new housing. And they've identified, I think, quite a few pieces of new housing that they need. Whether they've identified all or not, I'm not in a position to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. In looking at the plan that has been presented by the department, it seems to me that there are several policy decisions to be made. One is obviously the state policy to continue to provide housing to employees in parks, other things such as that, which is traditional with most states, and they've tended to support that sort of a notion.
What notion?
Of providing housing to troopers or housing to park rangers or ADF.
Yeah, do we do that because they're in a faraway place, or do we do it because the expenses are so great in that area? I mean,
you do it simply because you have to outstation them there, and there's no other housing accommodations available.
Okay.
As a practical matter, you wind up doing it. There are some gray areas.
When people work in Kotzebue, do we provide housing for them?
I know. I can't. I have a computer-run listing of any housing that would be in Kotzebue, but typically you find it at Kasieloff, you find it at Dead Horse, you find it in
Girl
some
State.
Of the, yes, right.
All right.
In examining the plan presented by the department for the 20 new units of replacement housing, the average unit cost was $162,500.
How big a place is it?
That's a three-bedroom, 1,200 square foot house. I looked at the procedures used in preparing the estimates, and basically what they did was to take the cost of a comparable house in Anchorage, and then through the use of the cost model technique that they have, apply what appeared to be the cost escalation factors for Dead Horse and Antioch, some other on Alaska, wherever the house were to be located. The problem with that procedure is that they've taken basically the cost of a stick-built house in Anchorage and assumed that all of the houses in these remote locations would also be stick-built. If you do the trade-off between on-site or stick-built construction versus prefabrication, according to construction firms I've talked to in both Anchorage and Seattle, they believe that a unit cost of $100,000 would be more than would be a reasonable price level. Prices out of Seattle indicate that a 1,200 square foot house insulated to meet Alaskan conditions can be delivered FOB Anchorage or Juneau for about $50,000 to $55,000, leaving additional transportation and or site work the balance. Prices for a comparable house out of Anchorage ranged from about $75,000 to $80,000. By firms manufactured there. I guess the point that I make is that in examining the executive branch proposal, the unit costs, the procedures used to determine unit costs appear to me to be excessive and based simply on stick building.
Would they just take the CPI and jack it up?
Yeah.
In other words, if certain village is 200% of the CPI in Anchorage, they just doubled
yes.
it?
Yes.
I mean, without any regard to what they really could build for in that area.
Or the alternative of fabricating elsewhere and doing just site erection. And so it seemed to me that the amount quite aside from your decision to replace state employee housing, you ought to be provided with a reasonable price for doing so at the various locations.
Russ?
Yeah.
Based on that $160,000 figure, if that's the one they're proposing, what do they propose to get rent for that housing they provide?
That's another point that I raised in this analysis, one of five issues. I suggest that you give consideration to what we call a fair rent plan, but inasmuch as rents are now been incorporated into many of your union agreements, as I understand it, which won't be opened up for several years, that it may be some time before you can achieve a fair rent policy. But it's one towards, if you're going to have equity among employees who live in their own houses and employees who live in state houses, you ought to have a fair rent plan, and you ought to do that during next negotiation.
Do we build a house and then we pay the rent too?
You probably heavily subsidize the rent and the utilities.
But the idea of negotiating that in the contract was that they are going to not be provided a house, and that if they went out on their own and got one, the rent would be exorbitant or inequitable to what they might do in a more urban setting. So we put in the contracts to subsidize that, and then at the same time we come back the other way and do it the other way. So we kind of do it twice.
It's my understanding is that because much of your housing is employee housing now is substandard, employees have asked to have the rent reflect the quality of the facility, which is, you know, which is reasonably fair request, quite aside from whether you put it in a bargaining agreement. But once you upgrade that housing to where you provide a quality housing and not a 20-year-old trailer house, then I think it's incumbent upon you to recover fair rent so that employee is not subsidized through the renting process and paid an equitable rate as well.
Mr. Chairman,
well,
Mr. Moss?
I might point out one thing. Somebody mentioned 160,000 units a while ago. We got $87,000 in Fort Yukon to build a Cooper house last year.
Yeah, right.
They
right.
bid on that thing, and the lowest bid was $140,000. So we're coming back this year to ask for the remainder of the money. I just thought I'd mention that to you when they were talking about the $150,000 figure.
Is that
we couldn't get nobody to build it for that.
Is that a stick-built house?
A stick-built house.
Yeah. I think you're going to have to give serious consideration to prefabricated houses on remote sites because of the
But I would expect us buying remote-built houses out from Washington or somewhere else. I want them built here in Alaska.
Certainly. I understand that.
Yes, well, the department instituted a fair rent plan 2 years ago, didn't it?
I know that there has been grievances filed and litigation filed over those.
I mean,
policy.
The employees are paying under this new rent schedule. That
the uniform rent based on the size and quality of the house, that's correct.
So that's already been done?
Well, to some extent, I think the rents are based upon about 85% of the rents charged for comparable facilities by HUD in Anchorage. The question comes on, though, as you bring on new or improved facilities, is that still an equitable basis for computing rent?
Well, it has, my understanding is the formula. We were involved in the committee hearing at one point a couple of years back, but as the new housing comes on, there's automatically a factor, as it goes from poor to fair to good, there's a factor that automatically kicks up the rent.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's right. We do have a policy, but it was installed largely at the request of Mr. Allen. I don't think it was completely implemented at the time of his departure. So I think you have a somewhat erratic situation where it still is possible for employees in one part of the state doing essentially the same kind of job and in the same kind of housing to be paying a different rate. And I think in some cases, worked into the bargaining agreement. So it's a thing that needs to be probably addressed consciously over a period of several years before it can get straightened out to the point where everybody's treated
equitably. Do these statistics include housing for the teachers in the rural school districts?
That's my understanding that does not.
This does not. This excludes teachers.
I believe so.
The teacher housing in the remote areas.
That's correct.
Okay. It's another. It's something you'll face another time, Chairman, whether it's included here or there.
Teachers.
in remote areas.
I might point out this is a different budget you're looking at too. That's usually a local school district budget or what have you. There are some areas that the school district does have some housing.
One of the several other lesser...
Could you, before you do that, on page two of this project, could you explain point number four, issue number four?
Well, one of the things the administration had brought a year ago was to put all employee housing under the Department of Administration with the goal of upgrading the housing and assuring some, eliminating discrimination which is occurring in housing. Some departments provided better housing to their employees than other departments. So consequently, they wanted to eliminate discrimination in the quality of housing. But what's happening now is Department of Public Safety, ADF&G, or other state agencies can, as a part of a capital project and in their capital budget, construct some employee housing. And once that housing is constructed, Department of Administration has no say-so over what standards it's built to. But once the housing is completed, then they take over the maintenance of it. So you can't, under that type of a system, have any uniform statewide standards for housing. Dot Puck could build a $200,000 house. Someone else could build a $20,000 house as part of their capital budget. Put it in, complete the facility, turn it over to Department of Administration to operate. And you're going to continue to have a hodgepodge of very expensive housing and very low quality housing, and cannot administer a program of uniform, non-discriminatory housing among your employees. That's point four.
Go ahead.
So I guess it leads to a conclusion is that the division of within the department, if it were the only state agency authorized to construct employee housing, you would be able to achieve a uniform statewide policy on housing. Lastly, there is substantial amounts of destruction occurring to state property, and an expansion of handyman agreements, the use of that procedure, would eliminate some of the damage and some of the need to send maintenance men out to repair furnaces and do that sort of thing. The third project that we examined was the Ketchikan Jail.
That's their problem.
And it is a problem.
And I just called your attention to page two. I think we only make really 2 points on the Ketchikan Jail.
How come Grusin did an analysis based upon outside construction?
I don't know.
National average, I mean, that's ridiculous.
I pulled a copy of their study because I didn't believe it myself, and it said national average costs in there,
and they didn't escalate.
And they didn't escalate. And that's correct. All of their facility studies were conducted on that basis.
Well, what bothers me is that Grusin also did the jail in Anchorage.
Yes.
And what else did they do?
They did all of your court and correctional facilities, so you can expect whatever they've been referenced as a study point, that they've used 6.5% rate of inflation and lower 48 national average construction costs, and made the assumption that state land was available at no cost.
I was wondering how they got down from 27 million to 12.3. I'd have them construct the capital.
top of page two, as you can see, there is since March of 78 through March of 80, relatively short period, the price of the Ketchikan Jail is a little better than double. And currently, there may be an additional request coming in depending on which site they finally select and the site development costs attendant to that facility. I understand the rate of inflation has occurred. I understand that there was a very bad base selected in the initial pricing. But what I think it does also suggest is two things to me, is that in your capital budget planning process as it currently exists, not enough attention is paid either to pricing or schedule control.
In other words, they just say, as of today, this would cost $1 million, and then you realize it's not even going to get the bid for a year and a half, but you don't ever take that into consideration.
In other words, when they do their cost estimates, it should be based on a minimum of having schematic drawings of the site selected. And perhaps you ought not even be bothered with projects until they've advanced to that stage, and they can provide you with some fairly definitive answers. And so that's not occurring now. And so really, there is no cost control or schedule control under the present system.
I'd like to make one point perfectly clear. This is not an attempt to sidetrack any facilities. It's the review here was to highlight those projects that have been put forth in the supplemental as needing to go instantly and so they get underway. As the problem of this analysis points out, Ketchikan Jail site hasn't been selected yet. It's quite conceivable that if the legislature had made the appropriation requested, they might have to come back before you adjourn to make yet another appropriation, which could be politically more troublesome than to make the one appropriation correctly in the first place.
Well, Jay,
that's really what we were after.
Jay, that's a good point, because the supplemental budget request, $949,300. I believe you have in front of you a supplement to that supplement for $522,300. In addition to that supplement, the supplement, if depending upon the site, an additional sum of money may be required. So we, as at this point in time, do not have before us the total cost for the completion of that facility. And I realize the difficulty of locating correctional facilities, but the choice is, do you put in $949,000 now in the supplemental, or do you wait until the regular budget when you can have the completed cost and can take the action in? And take one action to improve the facility. And that's simply the alternative that we raise in our analysis.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, I think the obvious solution is to put it in the mud type subdivision.
Hey, man, I'm looking there. Either that or we're going down there with this barbed wire and these guys walking.
But what assurance do we have that we'll ever come up with a figure that anybody can depend on?
It's difficult that in this time of inflation to do that, but what we found out in Washington made two significant changes. We required every agency as a part of the executive process to come up with schematic plans, and that's an architecturally defined end item, as a minimum for consideration of a capital project. If we felt the project was warranted, we may proceed at that point in time to either completely fund the construction or we fund the next set of architectural activities, which would be working drawings, so that we could monitor the project much more closely throughout its phase. That assured us greater schedule control as well as greater price control. And prices did vary, but at least we knew what the price was and people weren't always coming back with big cost overruns.
Yeah, but you know, with 20% inflation, if you wait 6 months, in fact, if you wait till the end of the year, you might miss a whole year. Yes. You're either going to have 10 or say you're going to miss 20%, and that's what it's running right now, and it might go higher.
Yes.
Who knows? I didn't think interest rates would ever go over 9%, you know, so 20% seems like it's unreasonably high, but it could be looking low in it by this time next year.
Yes.
20% inflation on what? It's getting close to $2 million now, huh? Well, more than that. 2.9. And then you got to add another one. It's going to be about $400,000 just in inflation, right there.
Yes.
You better to put the $400,000 in here and hope for the best, you know.
Russ?
Gary?
What was this, a bond proposal by the administration, or was it a...
It was a bond.
It was a original bond proposal.
Well, if you can listen to my song for the 100th time, you know, what you just mentioned, planning and designing and, you know, especially the administration should have plans and designs and at least the current cost, you know, for construction. And then you can go to bid in the same year as the bond is approved. At least you're going to hedge on inflation there. But this was in 78 and here it's 80, you know.
Yes.
Good God, man, it's no wonder that things go out of sight, not of control. It's a facility that's needed. You know,
our preference was so that if we funded working drawings to have a building capable of going out to bid within 90 days after the appropriation was made, and that's construction.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the legislature adjourns in May, and even if you had to have an inflation figure in there for, say, the next fiscal year, and had that represented in the cost, you know.
Yes.
You got a typo in here.
Oh.
on the second page.
I didn't make a screen.
It should be November 1978, huh? 1980, the bonds passed.
Oh, yes, right, 1978, you're correct, thank you.
Okay, let's go to the next one.
Chairman, I'd just like to make a suggestion, the last one I'll make, you know, on this subject. I think that this committee, with the experience we've had, and most of us have been here for several years, I think this committee ought to introduce a bill that plans and designs for capital, state buildings and stuff like that, that the plans and designs should be in hand and presented to the legislature, you know? There's been several commissioners that have suggested that over the years, you know? This facility should have been on the street if that practice would have been used by...
They had plans and designs for this facility, but they just were wrong.
I didn't hear you.
They had plans and designs, but they're just, it was incorrect. Is that right?
Well, all right.
Their estimates.
Why didn't we address it last session?
I believe if they'd had schematics completed and the site selected, I believe they could have moved much more quickly. And Carlos, I think that there's a problem of just getting the project managed correctly. The last item is the Castillo Apache modification, which is a request for $875,000, which essentially doubles the capacity of the hatchery by providing some additional rearing capacity in some egg-take facility. That part of the request seems to be quite reasonable. It makes the more optimum use out of a current facility. One thing I did note is that in the review by the budget office of the proposal, two housing units for the Castillo Apache were deleted. And I simply raised the question, if in fact you accept the basic premise that you're going to, you know, update state employee housing and renovate it, this policy seems to be inconsistent with the, with that overall...
Where is Castillo? I don't know.
It's in your district, yeah?
No, it's down in...
Beyond Kenai, between Kenai and Homer.
Me too, I was 18 miles off. Castillo.
On the highway to Homer, after you leave Kenai.
Malone's right there.
Mr. Chairman, this seems to be, appears to me to be arbitrary. On the one hand, to recommend a substantial housing program, same time be deleting housing, which is substandard, which currently exists in the facility.
And your last one, you, firefighter?
Yes. This is where I examine four issues. One is firefighting costs, of which of the $3.6 million requested, $3.2 million has been incurred already due in prior fighting, forest fire fighting, primarily related, my understanding, to Delta fires. $400,000, which of that amount would allow for some pre-season contracts, getting ready for the current season, as well as training of employees to get them their red card. The fire suppression fund of $5 million would allow them to draw upon that as a source of funding for fires. The amount of $5 million is arbitrary, might be set at some lower level. My guess is that level would be adequate for any particular year over the next few years, unless you had a really bad fire year. But that choice is discretionary with the legislature. The statewide fire warehousing indicates the kinds of equipment and buildings they've got to begin to provide. The state has to begin to provide itself because it's no longer going to be available through the Bureau of Land Management. Perhaps the most controversial item in this particular request is the two Canada Air CL-215 airplane for $5,067,000. I don't profess either to be a pilot or an expert on airplanes. If they are an appropriate vehicle for firefighting and have a useful life of 10 to 20 years, and that's a judgment someone else will have to make, then the second question is, should they be purchased or leased? And I've agonized over that, not only fire trucks, but airplanes used for the same purpose. And if they have a long, useful life, and you really can't share those between the BLM and the state or some other state, probably cheaper to purchase them outright. Use them sparingly and hope that you get a long life out of them so you don't have to replace them. There are some other issues within that overall firefighting. You're gradually acquiring substantial units of land, and you ought to have an overall firefighting plan based upon your land acquisitions over the next 5 to 10 years, so that you know where your warehouses and your base camps and your cooperative agreements are established, and you've got a chance to discuss such policies as lead burn areas and help the department fashion what the overall policies are.
They were requested to do that by Budget Nada, am I right about that, Jay? Didn't Serge Lewski bring that up or something, or, I don't know. Remember?
I remember that. I think it's been discussed, I don't think we reached.
It was in Senate Finance Room.
Right, remember that.
But the point was still made that they just fight every fire regardless of whether or not it makes any sense to them. Some fires, I guess, are not that harmful.
Well, it seems to me that they need to address the issue of a long-range plan to make sure that firefighting can become very expensive unless you manage it well. And you need to be looking at a long-range plan as well as they do to make sure that that happens.
And the guy that runs that now is just the guy that's head of the Division of Land and Water or something.
Mr. Chairman, I think probably what's going on here is that the Division of Lands and their classification of lands should designate these areas to be allowed to burn. In their classification of state lands, their overall classification of state lands.
Perhaps another area of legislative can be of assistance, legislation can be of assistance in examining their internal operating procedures for paying firefighters, determining who gets overtime, providing commissary supplies out there. Just the whole thing of administering a firefighter, it's done like we do with state employees.
Yeah, did you, but I also heard that because of the nature of going through certain proposals and stuff, that where guys at the Delta Fire, they had their own cats right there, and they would have worked for 50% of what the guy would have shipped his cat from Anchorage, or I don't know if this is a good example, but
it's an excellent example.
And then they hired the guy from Anchorage because of the ROA and the nature of the RFP, rather than just going out there. Any sensible person would take the money that you got available, go out there and hire everybody around there, put them to work, which would be nice for the local economy, but also you get it cheaper because you can get these guys for half price, that's right there, you don't have to transport them.
The same line of reasoning, Mr. Chairman, I think should be carefully pursued before you purchase a $5 million plane. Nobody owns a plane that costs $5 million or $500,000 unless there's so many operational hours. It doesn't pay to own it. And I would challenge that purchase very strongly unless you could state, and statistics will show how many hours you must operate in the office.
Let's turn the question around. In your investigation, did you find a significant amount of proof or backup that makes sense? Did you find anything like he's talking about?
In terms of hours of use of aircraft, I couldn't find that you have enough history here that I could really make an analysis of whether or not you could use one.
Well, airplanes are highly mobile, you can have a fire and you don't have an aircraft on site, but you could, in 5 or 6 hours you can get one from a whole hell of a long way away. You can get one from Seattle in 6 hours.
Let me address the fire truck and then come back and talk about that local contracting procedure, which is the heart of what I think we need to address in terms of an efficient administrative procedure for firefighting. I've drawn on the analogy of buying fire trucks for remote sites, and we bought a hell of a lot of those in 8 years, all over the state of Washington. They're efficient units for fighting fires, and you're beginning to acquire substantial amounts of land where there are no roads, so you're into aircraft. The question is whether you own them, lease them, or lease from someone else. My only point is that when you buy a fire truck, at least I learned over experience, you buy it and you keep it for a long time. And at least you try to amortize the unit cost of that aircraft over as many years as you can. And if you look at the mechanics of leasing versus buying, and you extend it out over 10 to 20 years, if the airframe of that aircraft is that long, you get a crossover point. The cost of ownership is cheaper than the cost of leasing, because you're going to get the full service of that over a period of time. So it's just a question of how quickly you burn up the life of that airframe. If you fly that aircraft heavily, use it heavily, it's going to have a shorter useful life to you. And that's just basic mechanics. The point I'm addressing is, the point that you're raising exactly, is that there are state procedures for handling local fire conditions and making decisions on the spot about purchase of local equipment and that sort of thing are so cumbersome that I'm amazed they put a fire out given those procedures. And I think some encouragement from the legislature to the Department of Administration to have them assist the Department of Natural Resources in developing payroll and purchasing procedures which are appropriate to firefighting, I think would help ensure that we'd have an orderly way of administering the logistics aspects of fighting the fire.
If there are no other questions, we'll adjourn the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Wally will be here through the rest of the week. He's going to sit at Dave Scott's desk in the morning. I don't know where he'll be in the afternoon, but for any members that have questions about these or any others.
Why? God.
I'll fix that sign.
You want something? I don't quite, Jim.
Can you come to order, please?
On the agenda today is committee substitute for House Bill 696. We'll have testimony from the President of the Senate and then the Speaker of the House. After that, we'll be taking up a separate subject, which is I asked Joe McKinnon to look into the problem of the bond, with the municipal bonding, and he's got a recommendation for the committee. That'll be after the end of this meeting. Mr. President, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The bill that came over from the Senate had taken a couple of givens that we're still waiting for opinion from the Attorney General's office, but I think we'll be quite correct. Number one, that funds of the permanent fund are a trust of the people and therefore can be dispersed, if this legislature so wishes, to citizens of the state of Alaska without dispersing them to citizens of the rest of the United States that might have been working here in Alaska. While funds from the general fund are taxes collected from all of the people regardless of their state and cannot be dispersed quite as readily to just the citizens of Alaska. You could disperse them on how long a person has paid tax, but not necessarily on their domicile. While if the permanent fund was large enough to have carried the total burden, you could have said only those domiciled within Alaska can receive any of the benefits. And so when we took a look at the problem before us, we looked at the fact that all citizens of the state of Alaska should get some benefit from their funds, but that those who pay taxes should get a little bit more of an edge. And so the bill, as passed by the Senate, has basically three parts. The first is a refund from the permanent fund that has to be supported for a while from the general fund due to the lack of money that goes to every taxpayer according to how much he has paid. You will giving a person credit for each year he's lived here up to 5 years. The reason we chose 5 years was the difficulty of getting any records further back from that. And even then, it's going to be difficult to get those, but they can be arrived at. This amount would refund, as our bill was, the total amount of last year's taxes. I'm told if you wanted to bring it up to date, there'd be no problem at all